For the rest of the hour, we're going to look back, not too long ago, to a time when the word, you know, that phrase Silicon Valley really didn't mean anything, when the land that's now filled with high-tech companies such as Apple, Hewlett-Packard, and Google was nothing but orchards. This week, memorial services were held for Jack Kilby, a Nobel laureate who was credited with the invention of the integrated circuit. That really is a way of arranging a set of solid-state components, you know, transistors and stuff like that, onto a single chip, and doing away with the bulky wiring, shrinking down the sizes of the components so they can fit onto a tiny little chip. That invention and a series of other inventions by Kilby, Robert Noyce, Gordon Moore, changed California and the world as we know it. Joining me now to talk about those early days in Silicon Valley and what it led to is Leslie Berlin. She's the author of a new book entitled The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. She's a visiting scholar in the history and philosophy of science and technology at Stanford University, and she is project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives. She joins us from a studio at Stanford. Welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
When would you say the actually Silicon Valley started? Is there a date that folks out there think this is the date that Silicon Valley started?
People often trace the start of Silicon Valley to the first startup that Noyce, Bob Noyce, and Gordon Moore, along with six of their friends, started in September of 1957. And the reason people often trace it back to that point is that Fairchild Semiconductor, when it basically dissolved, ended up populating the valley with all sorts of little semiconductor companies. Mm-hmm. And semiconductors, of course, are made out of silicon, and that's the origins of the name Silicon Valley. But historians prefer to look back a little further to the end of World War II and the start of the space race and mm-hmm. government funding for electronics that really helped the region take off with companies like Hewlett-Packard.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the history a little bit. Let's go back as far, speaking of World War II, post-World War II. Let's talk about Bell Labs and the invention of the transistor, the first solid-state devices that came out. Bob Noyce and others broke off from Bell Labs after the transistor, and they came out to California where they were called something terrible, weren't they?
They actually broke away from one of the founders of a company called Shockley Labs, mm-hmm. William Shockley, who had been one of the inventors of the transistor at Bell Labs. Noyce and his friends never worked at Bell Labs, mm-hmm. though Noyce did have a job offer there. So, yes, they left in 1957 and were promptly dubbed the Traitorous Eight by William Shockley. This was really one of the first times that you saw this startup or spin-off phenomenon that we now consider such a part of Silicon Valley happening. And one of the things that was so exciting for me to find was the notes that one of these eight young men who left took, where his boss's boss called the group of them into a room and essentially read them the riot act, saying, "Your names are mud." He ended with, "You should consider the community reaction. This is a disgraceful act." The notion of leaving a company was just not out there at that point.
Mm-hmm. You wrote The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. What was his relationship to the others, especially to Kilby, who wound up receiving the Nobel Prize for the invention? Would Noyce have gotten it also, you think, if he had lived?
Oh, he absolutely would have. As a matter of fact, Jack Kilby talked about that when he received the Nobel Prize. These two men invented independently and actually without any knowledge of what the other one was doing, but their work was completely complementary. What Jack Kilby came up with was a way to build a circuit, all of the different parts, out of a single piece of semiconductor material. And what Noyce came up with was the way to connect all of those parts at the same time they were printed. And this is really what led to much more reliable electronic systems than anyone had ever had before.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the birth of Silicon Valley this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. With my guest Leslie Berlin, the author of The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. You write in your book about Noyce that he attacked life. Noyce never stopped at the edge of a precipice, but instead ran at full speed right over the edge into the unknown. Is this what it took to start Silicon Valley? Is this the kind of people that were out there? There were go-getters, independent-minded, moving to California in that gold rush out west?
That's definitely a big part of what it took. I mean, the sense of adventure that Noyce brought to his life extended to things like every idea he encountered. He wanted to take it to the next level. He was just sort of an idea generation factory and was always looking to start the next new thing. That was a key part of getting these companies and ideas, getting their roots into Silicon Valley. And then he had people around him, people like Gordon Moore and Andy Grove, who were able to pick up the pieces of his ideas and actually figure out how to make them work. You needed all of those parts together. Noyce was the essential inspiration. He needed those people to do the perspiration.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, 1-800-989-TALK. Talking with Leslie Berlin. You say that actually Noyce might have won two Nobel Prizes if he had to live.
Now, this was another one of those very exciting things to discover, which was Noyce's work on something that today is called a tunnel diode that really no one had known about. This tunnel diode was one of the first devices to ever demonstrate that some of the principles of quantum mechanics actually could be observed in semiconductors. And the person who published first on the tunnel diode was a man named Leo Osaki, who won the Nobel Prize, shared the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1973. Noyce had come up with his ideas almost simultaneously, but he had never published them because his boss at the time, William Shockley, told him that they aren't very interesting. Go off and do something different. And Noyce was very young. He was newly hired, and he went off and did something different. Mm-hmm. And what was very interesting to me about that story was the way that Noyce spun it. He was a very modest man. In his entire life, I only saw one reference to this tunnel diode. And that context was that Noyce used this experience of his as a lesson on how not to manage innovators. He really believed that you had to give your innovators their head and let them run with their ideas, even if you didn't immediately see the practical applications. And about 15 years after William Shockley told him to go forget this idea, Noyce put the lesson he learned in practice at Intel when he really encouraged a young researcher named Ted Hoff to follow up on his ideas for something that we today call a microprocessor.
We're going to have to take a break and come back and talk lots more about Robert Noyce, the other pioneers in Silicon Valley, with my guest Leslie Berlin, the author of The Man Behind the Microchip. Take your questions, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the history of Silicon Valley. And my guest is Leslie Berlin. She's the author of a new book entitled The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. She's a visiting scholar in the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology Department at Stanford University. And she's also a project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives. And I guess we should, if you listen to the credits on Science Friday, you know that the Noyce Foundation is also an underwriter for Science Friday, so we should mention that right up front. Tell me about the, what is Project Historian for the Silicon Valley Archives? That sounds like an interesting project. Are there archives spread out all over Silicon Valley in people's basements and attics and things like that that you're trying to collect?
You've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. Stanford has been collecting in the area of Silicon Valley history for a long time. And when I would go to people's houses as part of my interviews, I would always ask if they had any papers. And the things that people pulled up from their basements and out of their attics in dusty boxes, and in one case a waterlogged box, which just broke my heart, were the founding sorts of documents of Silicon Valley. And even when they weren't that exciting, there were just people's notes and their thoughts. Silicon Valley is a place that always looks forward. And we're in danger of losing our past if we don't collect these materials. So I'd actually encourage any of your listeners who have materials to visit the website for the book, www.themanbehindthemicrochip.com, and they can reach me through that, and we can talk about preserving things, whether at Stanford or somewhere else. We just can't let them be lost.
Yeah, if they forget that, we'll send them to sciencefriday.com, where we have a link to it. Colleen in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I'm calling because I have a long-time interest in the development of the world of computers, and I'd like to ask your author if she was able in her research about Mr. Noyes to establish whether he was a charming, erudite communicator. Most of my experience with computer guys or girls is that they're brilliant, but not real good about getting the point across. And I'm always been curious about how the founders of this business were able to inspire, well, the confidence of the people that gave them a lot of money to develop this stuff.
Interesting questions. Question I'd like to know the answer to also. Leslie?
Oh, good.
Well, Bob Noyes was about 180 degrees oriented away from your classic sort of pocket protector mumbling kind of engineer scientist that people have a stereotype about. He was absolutely fantastically charismatic on the level of a movie star. People would repeatedly talk to me about having him walk into a room and people just turn around to stare at him. It wasn't so much his physical presence as his incredible brain power and also his real ability to inspire in the people around him a real confidence in themselves. Noyce liked to say, don't be encumbered by history, go off and do something wonderful. And when you think about what that would mean to somebody, a young employee or an entrepreneur, because Noyce supported a lot of next generation entrepreneurs, to hear someone say that to you was extremely meaningful. I interviewed about 140 people for this book, and several of them actually broke into tears talking to me about how much Noyce had meant to them. And then, of course, on the how did he get people to give him money side, he was extremely smart, had an excellent partner, was in a growth industry, and had a proven track record. So it was pretty much a slam dunk. For example, when he and Gordon Moore wanted to start Intel, their backer, Arthur Rock, found funding for them in less than 48 hours and said that he could have found it even faster if people hadn't had to return phone calls back then.
Wow. wouldn't you like to have met these guys, Colleen?
Absolutely. I read Tom Wolfe's long essay on the development of the Silicon Valley, and I will read this book as well because I think that they are the Thomas Edisons who's the other guy that invented the radio? I mean, of my generation.
The Marconi.
Marconi, and I don't want to be like your author has found. I did the archive, you know, I kept keeping the old papers
right.
at a small company I worked for. You know, I'd stash them away and put them in a box, keep samples of stuff, put it in a box. And the boss kept saying to me, what are you keeping all that stuff for? It's like, because someday you're going to want your history, and it'll be too late.
Thanks for
coming. Yeah, 10 years later, he thanked me.
Anyway, thank you.
Have a good show.
Thank you, Colleen. Have a good holiday weekend.
I think that Colleen is really building on another point that was such an interesting part of writing this book was Noyce's personality was giant, but he was surrounded by other people who were so interesting. So it was people like Andy Grove or Steve Jobs or Warren Buffett, who he served on a college board with. These were the people he dealt with, and they were just so interesting to talk to and so interesting to learn about. And that's that sort of sense of excitement I really tried to bring to the readers, because just the facts aren't going to tell the story of what happened.
And you talk about Steve Jobs actually being somebody that Noyce mentored. Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, Steve Jobs said to me, Bob Noyce took me under my wing, under his wing. He tried to give me a perspective that I could only partially understand. And as much as my historian's heart would have loved to have found some sort of a memo, you know, to Steve from Bob, subject line, how to run a high-tech company, this sort of thing didn't happen. The two spent a lot of time together, and really it was almost a process of osmosis where Jobs absorbed things about adventure and excitement in a way that you do from standing next to your grandmother as she cooks. My favorite Jobs Noyce story takes place in probably the early 1980s, and Bob had a plane called a Seabee that could land on water or land on land, and he wanted to show it off to Steve Jobs. They started to fly up to Lake Tahoe, and Noyce stopped at an intermediate lake, showed, look, it lands on water, and they took back off, and were, without either of them knowing it, Noyce inadvertently locked the wheels into water landing position, and when they went to land on the ground, the plane almost flipped. There was this bouncing. You know, Steve Jobs describes sitting there just white-knuckled, sparks shooting past the windows, and picturing this headline, Bob Noyce and Steve Jobs killed in fiery plane crash. And I think that Noyce gave Jobs living proof that this sort of sense of limitlessness and adventure and creativity and vision and energy that both these guys had in such abundance, you didn't have to give that up when you started running a company. That these could be the core of a high-tech company's approach to doing business and inspiring people. And it was a very exciting relationship to learn about, and just one of many, many mentoring relationships that Noyce had.
I'm sure there's no record of it, but one of them must have said, hey, let's do that again. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Harold in Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Harold.
Hi, my name is Harold Scheiberg. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I was in the class of 50, and Bob was in the class of 49 at Grinnell College.
Oh.
I knew Bob pretty well. He gave a lot of credit to Grant Gale, who was a physics professor at Grinnell. And Grant Gale, talk about Bob inspiring other people. Grant Gale is probably one of the inspirations that Bob Noyce had. And Bob was a great guy. He was a diver on the swimming team, a very compact man physically, and a tremendous skilled acrobatic diver. People don't know that too much about him either.
Leslie?
Did you
get it? You've nailed that perfectly, and everything you've said is right. And Noyce never, ever forgot how important Grant Gale's influence was for him. As a matter of fact, when he was awarded the National Medal of Technology, which is one of the highest awards our government can give to technologists, he invited Grant Gale to join him in the audience. And he always felt that science and engineering education was what was going to keep our country strong. And when people ask me what would Noyce think about what's going on today, there are a lot of things that would make him very happy. The innovation we have today and the prominence that Intel has achieved. But I think one thing that would concern him a great deal is our country's current ranking at number 17 in the percentage of college graduates who go into science and engineering. That would really give him some concern.
I think you're right. I like Bob. I didn't know him that well, to be honest. But I did know him, and he lived in the dormitory right next door to mine. And one time I was invited to a celebration of his getting his G for Grinnell when he got his G for diving. I'll let you go. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. I was actually going to ask you about that, what he might have thought about the failure of our educational system today. As you say, he really thought that's where our security lie in. And as you point out, other statistics show that in the last 20 years, the number of graduates, PhDs, scientists, and engineers has remained steady, even though the population has gone way up in this country. So I guess, is there anybody around today that you could point to that say, he's just like Bob was? Or are we lacking that kind of leadership?
I think one of the things that made Bob Noyce so important and so interesting was the number of different hats he wore.
Mm-hmm.
He was an inventor and an entrepreneur, but then he went on and donned a completely different hat when he was worried that the American semiconductor industry was under threat from Japanese competition. And took on a job that he never particularly liked, which was spending about half his time in Washington, D.C., lobbying for measures to try to help the American semiconductor industry. And I think at this point, that sort of variety of interest in someone so prominent is something that we could all really use, not just Silicon Valley.
Let's go to Steve in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Steve.
Hello there.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I worked with I worked at Intel in the 80s and 1990s and got to know Bob a little bit before his death, but worked obviously for 15 or more years with Andy Grove and Gordon Moore, and wanted to comment or get in Ms. Berlin's perspective. Each of those three were quite different from one another. Certainly Andy and Gordon, Andy Grove and Gordon Moore, very, very different personalities, and to the degree that I did know Bob, he again seemed different yet. You know, my perspective was that it really took all three of those guys to create Intel. I'm not sure that one or two of them could have done it. I don't know as much about the Fairchildren, the folks from Fairchild, but I had a sense that the team dynamic was very important, and I wanted your perspective on that.
Let me just remind everybody first that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking about Silicon Valley with go ahead, Leslie. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right. You had three very different personalities and, equally important, three very different sets of skills that started Intel. So the way that someone pointed it out to me, which I thought was beautifully, is that Noyce was sort of your long-range vision guy and your outside guy. He would sort of receive signals from the outside and say, someday we're going to be able to use semiconductors to do some fantastic thing. And then Gordon Moore would be the person to say, well, to do that, we're going to need to break through this technical barrier and think about these big ideas. And then Andy Grove would be the guy down in the trenches saying, well, that means we have to hire however many new engineers and build X amount of new fab space. So they did all three mesh together and complement each other very well. And at Fairchild, too, those eight guys who started Fairchild had been chosen by Shockley specifically because their knowledge complemented each other so well. They made a fantastic team and spent a lot of time together. At some point in the book, I describe how they would stand in a circle, shoulder to shoulder, just talking, lighting each other's cigarettes, holding two or three conversations simultaneously, and just the energy and excitement that they brought to this whole idea was fascinating and a very important part of their success early on.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I look forward to reading the book.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Joe in Jersey. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for. I'm so glad you took my call. Hi, Leslie. I am more of a MTV generation than a generation of the past of Bob Noyce and that and whatnot. I just was more asking about the days of today, Apple Computer's creation, like you said, with Steve Jobs and the perspiration and the inspiration and the perspiration. Steve Wozniak being perhaps the perspiration of Apple Computer and creating the first personal computer. And I was wondering if you got to interview him or touch upon anything related to that relationship as others in before that in your book.
I talked to Steve Jobs. I did not talk to Steve Wozniak.
I want to say one thing as a friend of Steve's and someone who knows that relationship very well. I got to visit recently Steve Wozniak, and about 3 weeks ago he had on his table, like you had mentioned, finding in people's basements and in garages, Steve Wozniak had on his table a little notebook with all his pencil scratchings and erasings of the creation of the first Apple computer and the first code, the first, I think it was BASIC or DOS code, I wouldn't even know it being a non-techie, and I couldn't even believe it. And I'm like, Steve, this belongs in the Smithsonian. And he's like, oh, It was so easy to do to me back then. I just spent...
Leslie wants it.
I was just going to say, actually, we have at Stanford the Apple Computer Collection, and that would be a perfect thing to include or anchor that collection. So, Steve Wozniak, if you're listening, give us a call.
Thanks for calling, Joe, and good luck. 1-800-989-8255 is the number. What is the future of Silicon Valley? Has it seen its best days, or the competition from overseas? You know, I was talking to the chairman of the board of Intel recently. He said, you know, we don't have to hire another person in the United States. We don't have to build another factory. Most of our business now is from abroad. Have we seen the best days of Silicon Valley?
Well, you know, the death knell of Silicon Valley has been sounded many times, with the Japanese competition being sort of the most recent incarnation. And one of the reasons that the subtitle of the book is The Invention of Silicon Valley is that this area and the people in this area have had the ability to reinvent themselves and their interests again and again. And when Noyce died in 1990, who would have thought that you were going to rejuvenate the entire area with this whole internet and networking concept? It just wasn't out there, but it rose from the fertile soil that we've got here.
Well, Leslie, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. Leslie Berlin is the author of the new book, The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. A really interesting read if you would like to know about the man and the institution that was created. She's also a project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. Our intern is Todd Neal. If you missed any of the links we talk about, surf over to sciencefriday.com. We're podcasting Science Friday. You can download this and back editions of Science Friday to your iPod, or listen in real audio, or take it with you on your audible.com player. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.